This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Edward Norton had no trouble getting noticed after he started making movies. He was nominated for an Academy Award for his feature film debut in Primal Fear, in which he played an altar boy on trial for murder. Then Woody Allen cast him in his musical Everyone Says I Love You. He played Larry Flint's lawyer in The People vs. Larry Flint and received another Academy Award nomination for his role as a skinhead in American History X. He also starred in Fight Club, 25th Hour, and Keeping the Faith, which he directed. His new film is The Italian Job. Norton plays a thief, Steve, who double-crosses his gang on a heist. In this scene, Steve meets his ex-partner Charlie, played by Mark Wahlberg, in a restaurant. It's been a year since Steve stole the take from the gang.
Same old Steve, huh? Always thinking defensively. That's why you're always number two.
How do you figure that?
You got no imagination. Couldn't even decide what to do with all that money. I had to buy what everybody else wanted.
Oh, well, try this on in your imagination, okay? That gold is already gone.
That's bull, Steve.
No, really, it's over, Charlie. I'm trying to move the last two bricks. You want to come after me over a couple of lousy bricks? I mean, really, be my guest. Really, but you're off to a bad start, you know? Because you just blew the best thing you had going for you. You just blew the element of surprise.
Surprised?
Terry spoke with Edward Norton in 2000.
Let me ask you about your first movie role, which was Primal Fear. In fact, let me play a clip from it. In this, you play a former altar boy named Aaron who's from a small town in Kentucky. You're accused of brutally murdering a cardinal. Your lawyer is played by Richard Gere. Now, you claim to suffer from amnesiac blackouts, and a psychiatrist hired by your lawyer thinks that that's a symptom of multiple personality disorder. In this scene, after your lawyer tells you that he thinks you're really guilty, your other personality, Roy, comes to the surface. And this is the first time your lawyer has seen evidence of a split personality.
You're a lawyer. You was lawyer, ain't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, with your fancy suit. I heard about you. Well, my, my. You sure f*** this one up, counselor. It sounds to me like they're gonna shoot old Aaron so full of poison it's gonna come out his eyes.
Where is Aaron?
Aaron's crying off in some corner somewhere. You scared him off. You gotta deal with me now, boy. I'll give you a beating on principle. Look at me. You ever come in here and pull any of that tough guy shit on Aaron again, I will kick your ass to Sunday. Do you understand me?
I understand you. I understand. Aaron gets in trouble, he calls you. You're the man.
Well, Aaron couldn't kick his own ass. I mean, you seen him with the
Yeah.
Jesus Christ, he can't handle anything. Now, he sure as shit couldn't handle all that preacher's blood, could he? If he'd have done like I told him, we wouldn't be in this mess. But he got scared and ran off, got himself caught, the stupid little
So Aaron did kill Rushman.
What? Hell no! Jesus Christ, where'd they find you? Ain't you been listening to me? Aaron don't have the guts to do nothing. It was me, boy. It was me.
It was you.
Yes, it was.
It was you.
That's Edward Norton and Richard Gere in a scene from Primal Fear. So this was your first movie role, a big part. How did you get it? How did you get such a good part the first time out?
I don't know. That was weird listening to that for me because I don't think I've watched that movie since the week it came out. I was listening to it like I didn't even remember that's what that scene was about. It was wild. I just haven't revisited that in a long time.
You have a foul mouth, sir.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That guy. He's a tough character, but the. That was very interesting. We improvised a lot in those scenes, so a lot of that was just stuff that kind of, you know, we kind of riffed around the basic components of the scene, and Richard was really good at that, so it was fun to do.
So how did you get the part?
Well, it was a situation where they, obviously by its nature, it's a role that has to do with first impressions and deceptions and kind of acting within acting. And I think that wisely, Greg Hoblit was aware that it was something that if the audience could actually be fooled in the same way that the lawyer is being fooled, it would be very effective as opposed to, you know, if it was an actor that people were familiar with and so they were aware of the artifice on some level from the beginning, that could kind of diminish it. And I think he was very intent on trying to find someone who was unfamiliar to audiences, and so as a result, they engaged in a you know, in an audition search. And so it was a very unusual circumstance of a very, very good part where they were really looking around and they went all over the place. And I was obviously acting in New York in a theater at the time, and the casting director for Paramount had seen me in some plays and brought me in among many, many others to audition for Greg. And it kind of went on from there.
Was this audition an interview, or did you have to do lines?
No. It's always if they're doing it right. I mean, I think one of the worst things that can happen in an audition is when you walk in the room and there's a director and producer and they start talking to you, because it's just like, I mean, try to imagine going to see, you know, Dustin Hoffman and Rain Man, and before the movie starts, a little thing comes up on the screen, and Dustin Hoffman says, "Hi, I'm Dustin Hoffman, and I'm about to play this role, and I hope you all enjoy the film." And then you watched him play that character. It's like it just punctures.
Absolutely,
it punctures the bubble. And I think I've always said, whenever I've gone to classes or you know, to places where younger actors want to ask questions and things like that, one of the things I've always said is, don't let them do that to you. You know, when you go into an audition, do not let them talk to you beforehand, because it's like, it's just like cutting the legs out from under everything you're about to try to do, which is to say, fool them in the same way that you're going to fool an audience, even when it's not such a deceptive character, even when it's not a character who is pulling such a trick on people. Even if it's just a, you know, me playing, I don't know, you know, like any of the characters I've played in films, you don't want to walk in and talk and be yourself and then launch into this character, because it's automatically going to sort of seem more like a put-on.
What would make it even worse, I think, is that you had to do a Southern accent for this. So they hear
accent.
Your regular accent and then they go,
especially,
oh.
Absolutely. Yeah. I have a theory about accents, which is that if someone, I mean, I think if you walked up to any, even if you did a bad British accent, say, if you walked up to someone and you were doing it, and that was the first time they met you, no one would question it. Whereas, you know, I could walk up to a lot of people right now and do an absolutely flawless British accent, and by virtue of the fact that they know that I'm not British, they'd be saying, oh, well, that kind of doesn't sound right to me. I think people have a very relative, their critique of things is relative to how aware they are that you're doing a put-on, you know. And I think when actors have to do a accent or anything like that, if you have to go into an audition, it's the worst thing in the world is to have to talk to the people beforehand and then launch into this, you know, because they're going to, in their minds, they're going to go, I don't think he's doing that well, you know.
Fight Club is a movie about people who find meaning in life by joining this very secret club in which they fight each other quite hard. I'm going to play a clip from early in the movie where all we really know about your character is that he's a young guy who's just really disenchanted with the life he's found himself leading, worrying about shopping for the right bedspread and the right coffee. And he's a numbers cruncher for a car maker, and he's becoming an insomniac. So he tries to find peace of mind by attending support groups for problems he doesn't even have. His job requires him to do a lot of traveling, you know, by plane. And this is him thinking about all the travel and all the trivialities and mind-numbing stuff that it leads to.
You wake up at SeaTac, SFO, LAX. You wake up at O'Hare, Dallas-Fort Worth, BWI, Pacific, Mountain, Central. Lose an hour, gain an hour.
Check-in for that flight doesn't begin for another 2 hours, sir.
This is your life, and it's ending 1 minute at a time. You wake up at Air Harbor International. If you wake up at a different time, in a different place, could you wake up as a different person? Everywhere I travel, tiny life, single serving sugar, single serving cream, single pat of butter, the microwave cordon bleu hobby kit, shampoo conditioner combos, sample packaged mouthwash, tiny bars of soap. The people I meet on each flight, their single-serving friends. Between takeoff and landing, we have our time together, but that's all we get.
That's kind of like the urban, neurotic, alienated, professional version of rap. Did you do that voiceover with the music or without it?
No, without it. Without it. We spent a lot of time in booths like this one working. We tried every kind of mic, close to the mic, far from the mic. We experimented just into infinity with finding exactly the right tone to create the feeling of that voice that's in your head, so that it would have a quality distinct from sort of what we're used to hearing in voiceovers, you know, of really almost being inside the brain, that voice that you're talking to yourself with, you know. And the narration, obviously, it was such a critical component of the novel that we felt it needed to be a part of the film as well.
Is narration very hard because it's not like you're talking to somebody, and yet you have to make it really believable as that inner voice?
It is. And it has to be a characterization. I mean, especially in the case of this film where the underlying reality, the underlying truth of the film is revealed to be something very different from what the narrator himself is presenting it as. It's a bizarre comparison in a way, but, you know, I've always thought what's great about a book like The Catcher in the Rye is that it's told in a first-person narrative by a narrator who's not a very reliable, source of perspective on himself, and you learn things about Holden Caulfield that he's not really telling you about in the dialogue, in the scenes where what he's saying to people kind of goes against what he's saying to you in his inner monologue. And this reminded me of that because my character in Fight Club is a totally unreliable source of information about himself. He's telling you a version of his story that, as the story goes along, you realize is a completely deluded understanding of his own problems. You have to make, that has to be, the voiceover can't just be a narration, it has to be a characterization.
Which leads me to say, without giving away too much of the story, that you've played a lot of like double personalities and double roles in your career where your character undergoes some kind of transformation and is both good guy and bad guy.
Yeah.
Why do you think you've had so many roles like that?
Well, I think that any character should undergo a transformation. I mean, that to me is what drama is about. It's like I had a good acting teacher one time who said, you know, you should always be able to look at a scene and certainly a whole piece and say, you should be able to look at a drama and identify what happens that changes things in it. I mean, a story should be at its fundament, you know, something happens as a result of which something changes. And if a character doesn't transform on some level in a story, it's not worth playing, because I think that's why people are going to movies, to plays, reading novels, because you want to read about people evolving in some way. That's what you connect with. And I think that in Fight Club, it's very different from Primal Fear in the sense that it's Primal Fear is about somebody acting, basically. Fight Club is about a person actually going insane.
Right.
And not knowing that he's going insane. And obviously I don't play both halves of his personality. I play one half, and I play the half that is learning, a guy who has to come to grips with the fact that he's crazy, and has to realize how crazy he's gone. So even though on a loose level there it's connected with Primal Fear, it really was a very different sort of a thing. But what I liked about it is it's a character who he changes. His sense of his own desperation in the beginning leads him to experiment with a kind of a solution that he ultimately realizes is very, very negative and very unhealthy, and from which he pulls back and finally by the end, you know, defines himself. He finally, I think on a certain level, right at the end, figures out who he is on his own.
Edward Norton speaking with Terry Gross. He stars in the new film, The Italian Job. We'll hear more of their conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back now to an interview with actor Edward Norton. He stars in the new film, The Italian Job.
Let's get to another one of your movies, Everyone Says I Love You, which was Woody Allen's musical in which he had actors who really aren't singers singing songs for the film. You had two songs, Just You, Just Me, and My Baby Just Cares For Me. Let's hear a little bit of My Baby Just Cares For Me.
My baby don't care for rings or other expensive things. My baby just cares for me. My baby don't go for big Rolls Royces. There's sometimes a doubt about her choices. My baby don't care to own some 14 karat stone. She's sensible as can be. My baby don't care who knows it. My baby just cares for me.
Edward Norton, what were your thoughts when you found out you had to sing in order to be in Woody Allen's movie?
I felt much the same way I feel right now, having played that back in my ear. I feel like putting a paper bag over my head. You're officially turned this into a torture booth now that you've played my played me singing back to myself.
Did you know right at the start that singing was essential for all the players?
No, nobody knew. I remember when I met Woody for the second time, and it seemed to be going well in terms of, you know, him wanting me to do the part. Right toward the end, you know, he came over and he went, you know, I read a scene and he went, you know, that was perfect, that was great. And, you know, by the way, do you sing at all? You know, and I kind of went, what? You know, sure, you know, and not in a great way, but is the character a singer? And he went, well, you know, I'm not looking for Pavarotti. I'm just something I'm playing with, you know. And I was going, I wonder what that's about. So I got the part and I was all excited. And about a month, you know, a couple months went by, and about a month before we started shooting, I got this call from Dick Hyman, who's Woody's longtime music supervisor and arranger and kind of a genius of orchestration and arrangement. And, you know, and he said, I'm going to have you get together with a voice person in Los Angeles because we need to get your range. And I went, what, you know, what is this for? And he said, well, we're making a musical. You know, I kind of like started hyperventilating, and apparently everyone else had pretty much the same experience, because he didn't want to give anybody any time to panic and go out and, you know, work on it. He wanted everybody to sound, the whole idea was people coming off the, you know, the characters like normal people just bursting into song with all their, you know, cracking voices and everything. He did not want a polished thing.
Nevertheless, did he want you all to take some voice lessons?
No, not at all. In fact, he insisted that we not do it. And in fact, when I went and laid down, we pre-recorded the song so that we could sing back to our, you know, lip sync to or sing along with our own playback when we filmed it. And I pre-recorded the songs, and you know, of course, I had worked on them because there was no way I was going to go in cold, and I did it. And about a week later, I got a call, you know, and they said, "Woody wants to talk to you about what you recorded." And I just went, "Oh no, I'm getting fired," because Woody lets a lot of people go. It's kind of he. Woody's famous for, you know, firing people, and I thought, "This is it. I'm out." And I went back in to see him, and he said, "You know, we need to do it again because you sound too good. You sound like Perry Como. You know, I need you to scale it back a little bit." So he actually made me come in and do it worse. I had a couple tracks that I was really happy with, and he made me come in and kind of sing it more like a guy on the street, you know.
So what impact did this movie have on your own self-consciousness about singing?
I try to shut it out, and occasionally someone will do what you just did and throw on the soundtrack, and it'll all come raging back to me like a
bad dream.
No, the experience. No, I'm kidding. It's just hard to hear it, you know, disconnected. I love watching it in the film, because I think the film is, you know, so light and funny, and actually that song, "My Baby Just Cares for Me," is the one in the Harry Winston's jewelry store where the whole musical number erupts in the jewelry store, and I think it's a hilarious sequence. But out of context, it's a little bit like looking at your high school yearbook pictures.
Edward Norton, from an interview recorded in 2000 with Terry Gross.